Welcome to season 3 of An Hour or So with me, Sue Perkins. Well, we're back in lockdown, so we are continuing to record interviews remotely. We've got loads of great guests coming up, but today I have the venerable Dame Emma Thompson, don't you know? I always like to start off with a dame. There's nothing like it. We discussed, to begin with, how she's been coping with the stress of COVID.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue.
What is your coping mechanism during these times?
Actually, it's breathing.
Breathing?
Yeah,
breathing. Deep breathing.
Deep, proper breathing. Yeah, lots of that. And lots of sitting. It would be very good for you, Sue. Pranayama breathing, look it up.
I've heard of it. Somebody tried to get me into it and...
I've got to tell you, it would really help.
I think it's going to be better than diazepines and beta blockers and marijuana. Or is it?
So. Well, beta blockers are great, but yeah, really good when you need them. But breathing really is helpful. And so when I get a bit flooded with it all, which happens, worrying about everybody and dealing, the whole school meal and children thing at the moment is so desperate.
Yes,
so, yeah, that's what I do. So I go back to the simplest possible thing, which is just sitting very, very quietly on my own somewhere, breathing.
I mean, we can't not talk about... Now you mentioned school meals, I can't not talk about it. I should probably mention we are recording this on the 27th of October. Mm. I say that in the vain hope there'll be some U-turn. People will go, God...
Another
listen to them chatting, yeah, but they won't be.
I think there may be the Food Foundation, Marcus's lot have got a petition up and there's nearly a million signatures on it. So I saw Deb Francis White the other day and she said, do you want to do an emergency guilty feminist podcast on it? And I said, that would be great. And we could talk to the young ambassadors from the Food Foundation who've all kids who've suffered this food insecurity, they call it, in the sector, you know. But basically, it just means that these kids have often and many a time just gone hungry, not gone to school without any breakfast. And we've been hearing stories about that for a long time. But I think folk find it very difficult to believe, and I don't blame them. But unfortunately, they perhaps aren't, you know, when it's very difficult to be aware of this kind of modern poverty and the fact that even if you're on your universal credit, even if you've got a job, you just can't earn enough to feed your family or feed them well. And so.
Yeah. And I wonder where we got to this stage where blame became such a significant sort of driver in modern discourse. So immediately, I noticed this very profoundly on social media, parents came in for a slew of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
For what? For trying to feed their family and through circumstances beyond their control, not being able to do so. And then, of course, you have an MP saying, well, I've seen people in my constituencies selling food for drugs.
Yes.
Like you're suddenly going to buy 4 grams of weed with a Frey Bentos. It's not happening. That's not really happening on the street.
No, and I wonder where he actually saw them or whether he, you know, maybe he was just trying to try buy some drugs. One can only hope. But I mean, it's not a good situation. And old Marcus Rashford, I was up in Manchester with him the other day doing a bit of filming. And of course, he was just incandescent with fury. And but really good. I mean, really... so articulate and very interesting about his mum, of course, who did have a job and had all these boys, 4, I think, and just worked 14-hour shifts, came home. There was a slow cooker he would eat. But when he was training, when he was little, he'd just eat cereal all day because there was nothing else. So it's not about... And I did something on the radio 4 about a year and a half ago about this very subject and got that from one of the presenters, from Justin Webber. And he was, isn't this, he said, it's feckless parents. So actually, the blame thing is Dickensian. I mean, that's from Dickensian times.
And the response
I thought we'd moved
that,
away from that. You
well,
know?
I think we're tracking right back. I mean, the more that it's in the sort of public eye, as it should be, the more I'm thinking about my own childhood
and, you know, the milk snatcher days, you know, the idea that what's best is that we take feeding children or helping those in poverty away from local government and actually to put it in the hands of the private sector. And when that happened in the 80s, of course, nutrition just fell through the floor. Everything was done on the cheap. And if we've learned anything from this crisis, I would say that everything health related, and that includes feeding kids, is done through public health, through well-funded, centralised bodies that aren't going to pass judgment on families doing their best. Makes me very angry.
No, absolutely.
What was the first thing that got you furious? Doesn't have to be political, but the first sort of prickle of injustice when you were little.
Oh, when I was little? It was school. There was a girl in our class who was, you know, she had some clearly quite an unusual set of parents. And for instance, she would sit in the any kind of sex education or biology with her fingers in her ears humming loudly. You know, so there was something going on there. And she had a quite odd appearance. You know, she looked very kind of old in a way, and she was very badly treated by some of the girls. So I took to sort of trying to protect her, because I really couldn't stand it. And I think there are some folk, I met a couple of them actually, a couple of the young ambassadors who work for the Food Foundation, actually aren't, they haven't been through it themselves, but they have seen and witnessed shaming and bullying, and they don't understand it, and they feel a deep, urgent need to do something about it. And I've always had that.
I think yes, I agree. I mean, I think my first experience of bullying wasn't being bullied myself, but seeing it happen around me, and that deep, deep sense of disquiet that it creates, because it could be you. It could be you. And I'm sure, you know, as an adult, people have tried to make it me, and I've resisted it. I wouldn't say as successfully as you've done. I have huge anxiety as a result. But yes, that idea of, hang on, if we allow the marginalisation of this one person, then when you've finished with her or him, then who's going to be next? Because the fire isn't going to burn out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it's still, and I have, you know, nieces and godchildren who have intermittently gone through things that are just overwhelming. I mean, things that we didn't have to deal with when we were kids, particularly because of social media. No. You know, the idea that bullying is viral within a post, you know, within a click.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's incredibly dangerous, and everyone's got to watch The Social Dilemma, because that's very interesting, hearing all the young white men of Silicon Valley saying, well, we wouldn't allow our kids onto these things, and speaking so articulately about what this is, what we've got ourselves into with social media, because there were the people inventing it made it addictive on purpose.
Yeah.
It was made addictive on purpose. And when people within the industry said, excuse me, I think we need to be a little bit more aware of what we're doing here, because this is addictive, they were shut down and ignored.
I mean, there's no small sense of irony in knowing that it was originally, the internet was a sort of military-based kind of intranet kind of system, and it has weaponized society. It's weaponized you against me. I mean, not you specifically, but you know, it has highlighted division and inequality and permitted fury and hate speak and all sorts of stuff, just so that we can Google, you know, Wikipedia, get wiki results quickly.
Exactly. I mean, I think that on the other hand, discussions and debates having died completely, almost completely, in the public arena, are now happening in podcasts and social media arena. There are some discussions going on that I think are new and different, and that I find very hopeful. And I think Generation Z are hip to the algorithms a little bit more than we are, certainly. I mean, I think you know, I'm 61 and I look at it all and go, I don't get it. I don't like machines. But then I wouldn't, would I? Because I didn't grow up with them. But my daughter says, Mum, I know this stuff. I know what they're doing. And I go, really? Okay. And I don't understand. They just have a relationship with what I see as something fantastically baleful that is quite sort of dismissive, really. I mean, she's quite contemptuous of the algorithms that make her buy things and make her.
So she knows she's
being
profiled, or that she's very aware.
She's aware of it, yes. And clearly, well, either she's, you know, going to suddenly throw the phone out the window, or she's going to make it work for her. I don't know. But this generation, her generation, I think, who were the guinea pigs, frankly, they're the ones who are going to change it. They're the ones who are going to turn around and say, we cannot conduct ourselves like this anymore. And our social media platforms have to have controls on them. They absolutely have to, clearly.
Yeah, and we took millions of years to be able to stand upright. And yet the moment now that my baby niece was able to walk, she went up to the television and tried to swipe right with it. So that's happened in that technological evolution and the way it's impacted us. But it impacts everything. It impacts the way we think. You know, if you've read it, there's an interesting book called, I think, The Shallows, which is about how our brains are obviously plastic, and the internet has basically reduced the bandwidth of our concentration span and our sort of memory capabilities.
Indeed.
But also physiologically, we don't move so much. We're just sat, you know, calcifying, looking at, you know, pornography, or in my case, Gems of War, which is something I got very heavily involved in during lockdown, which is a child's game. Oh, I'm on all the Discord chats about with loads of fellow gamers, and I've got pseudonyms coming out my arse. And I just look at this shit, and I thought, God, I could be doing something. If I just put some pants on and went outside, I could be doing something. So I speak as somebody who's been slightly reeled in, but it's also, like you, terrified of the whole thing. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Harry's.com. Now, if you haven't heard of them, Harry's is a subscription service for men's shaving products at affordable prices. The company was set up by Jeff and Andy, who were just fed up with overpriced razors and set out to fix shaving. To do this, they bought their own factory in Germany, which has been making blades for 100 years. They've just released their sharpest ever blades with a new lubricating strip, don't you know, for an even closer, more comfortable shave. And the best part? Harry's have not raised their prices, so you can get replacement blades for as little as £1.75 each. Listeners to this podcast can now get a trial set for just £3.95. Go to harrys.com/hour to get started. The set includes a weighted ergonomic handle, the new 5-blade razor cartridge, shave gel, and travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move. You can also check out Harry's range of face care and hair products, as well as their shave and shower travel kits. Get the comfortable shave you deserve. I'm looking a bit shaggy myself. Maybe I'll get some. Head to harrys.com/hour to claim a trial set for just £3.95. And you'll also be supporting our podcast by doing so. So thank you.
But I'm very impressed by some of the young women gamers I've heard speaking on various podcasts, and they talk with it, because they receive the most extraordinary amount of abuse when people find out that they're women. And you go, huh. So because Laura Bates has just brought out that book, hasn't she, about the sort of misogyny on the net and the dark net and everything. And I find that very interesting, because years and years ago, when I first became a kind of card carrying feminist, my mum said, well, women just aren't very popular at the moment. And I think she was referring to
by at the moment, did she mean since the dawn of time?
Well, yes, she was sort of, she's fond of saying, well, we're barely out of the slime, which is true, but also she said that as we moved into the workplace, which we know, we became less and less popular, and misogyny rose and rose, and it seems to be at record heights at the moment, in a particular kind of male environment. You know, it's only particular kinds of men. It's quite niche, but it's very pervasive, and it's and quite powerful and quite convincing to an awful lot of men. It's important to be aware of it, but I find if I get too aware of it, I get a bit paranoid.
Yeah. But it's also important to balance things, isn't it? I mean, also you're able to balance your work and your activism with the most fun job in the world. I hope you still find it. Exactly. Do you still find it fun?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Is it still playtime?
It is completely playtime. I mean, obviously, it is. I just did a job for Disney, which was such good fun. It was Cruella with Emma Stone, and I was playing her nemesis, and in the biggest wigs I've ever worn, and the biggest costumes I've ever worn. So, I mean, it was getting into the makeup chair at 4 o'clock in the morning and swanning onto set 5 hours later, £6 heavier, and that was just the mascara. So that you know, it's the playtime bits are fantastic, and then the prep bits take a long time. But it's so much fun, and I love my day job. It's fantastic.
What would you have? I mean, was it something that you is it in your blood? Did you actively consider it? Like, people can't believe when people say I fell into it, but I do think a lot of creative people fall into it in that they want to do something that interests them. They want to tell stories, but they don't have a formalised sort of direction.
No.
I mean, for example, for me, I had no idea what I wanted to do other than just I was really curious. So I wanted to be around people, and I wanted to find out everything all at once. Mm-mm. And it just so happened that was the channel I found. There could have been multiple other channels, or I could have ended up in prison. But
it's true. But you weren't sciencey, so you couldn't have gone to be a marine biologist.
No, but increasingly I am sciencey, which is what's brilliant about getting older, is you think, okay, it wasn't, as I was led to believe at the time, a lack of intelligence. It was very likely a lack of application. But also I wasn't taught some subjects, wasn't taught very well. And there's a formula, there's a way into science that if you're not given at an early age, it's gone. But now I find pure mathematics extraordinarily interesting. I find the cosmology really, you know, all those sorts of things, string theory. I can't say that I really understand all of it. Time. Why does time move at a different rate in the mountains than it does on the plains? All that stuff. But yeah, I wasn't at the time sciencey, so you're right. I was always heading towards a very nondescript beige second class honours degree in English literature. Now I see it.
Yeah.
You know, but at the time it felt more haphazard than that.
No, I think you're right. We were also told when we were young that you were either arts or science, which is just nonsense.
Were you ever sciencey? It's not. Did you ever get into...
No, but I liked maths because I had a good maths teacher. And I didn't like physics because my physics teacher was a sadist. So, you know, I can't say... I love physics now, like you say. I get really intrigued by it. I'm so curious about it. And yes, cosmology. My daughter-in-law's studying astrophysics. It's completely amazing, all of that. And I'm very sorry that I didn't have more access to those ideas. But anyway, look... We are who we are because of what we come into contact with as we grow up, and there's nothing to be done about that. You've got to come into contact with something, and you can't push yourself in every single direction at once either. I mean, I think that unless you're Voltaire, obviously, but hardly anyone is, I find. So I was at school in Camden Town. And it happened to be a school that taught classics very well. So, weirdly, Latin was my favourite subject at school.
What did you study? You didn't study classics, did you? Or did you?
No, I studied English literature.
But classics gives you such... I'm obsessed with classics. I mean, I don't... Yeah. Latin.
Latin. It's just literally the most fabulous thing.
And it's the foundation of so much else. But also that gets you into mythology. And once you're into mythology, then you have opened
up... That's the best.
...the most fantastical, you know, space. I return to that all the time.
Yeah, because the mythology is absolutely... I was obsessed with it when I was 13. And my Latin teacher, I'd ask her to give me extra questions on any kind of myths. And I would... do little quizzes and she did it. God bless her. She had a whole class. It didn't occur to me that I was just adding to her workload, but I was completely fascinated by myths because they were so disconnected from the, you know, the very kind of meat and potatoes Christian culture that existed in my school. It was very straightforward and you know, doubtless splendid in its own way. But I found myths kind of led you off in all sorts of different directions. And you thought, he did what with who? She slept with her father?
Her
hair is snakes. What?
He's really got horse's legs. The fuck? What the fuck has he got horse's legs for? What's he going to do with them?
He jumped her own dad up and threw him in the sea.
great
women.
Oh my, yeah. And then that's, I'm trying to think what my favourite, do you have a favourite myth? I'm trying to think what mine would be.
Oh God.
It connects to every part of life. And I guess the thing that I got most out of when I studied, in the brief window that I did study when I was at college, was Greek tragedy. Because again, that mythology, as you say, very, very strong women. And, you know, it's sort of Cassandra, the epitome of all female experience. She's just saying, this is going to happen. No one's listening to me. It's happened. I told you so. Now I'm going to be the bitch that just goes around kvetching saying, look, I told you this was going to happen.
Cassandra is tops, isn't she?
Cassandra's
poor cow.
Poor
honestly.
Cow.
And that was her curse. Her curse was to see everything and never to be believed. I mean, that is just extraordinary, isn't it? To be put, what a clever curse as well. If you want to make someone's life miserable,
those goddesses,
they knew how to really fuck people up, didn't
they? They really did.
But in really, like really original and interesting ways. I mean,
it's true. Like sometimes it was base level. Sometimes it was like, I'm not turning into a swan. But yeah, then that's quite good as well, because swans very, very limited to hissing and being force-fed bread that they don't want. Nutritionally, it's useless to them.
Yeah, and it's only leading them towards being eaten by queens.
Yes, exactly. They'll end up on a royal platter, and that's if they're lucky. And people of limited imagination will constantly use them as a reference point for feeling stressed on the inside but not expressing it on the outside. Or is that ducks? I can't remember. Even swans can't even lay claim to that. It's, you know. I remember once an awful scene on Hampstead Heath where a man had tried to catch a swan to eat it. Really nice guy, but just says, oh, no, well, I was going to catch a pike, but I ended up catching this, and that's okay. And people, this bloke came along and just went, only the queen, mate. Knock it. Knock it on the head.
They're not even very nice swans, so I
to eat?
Fish, no, bit greasy.
I've eaten the peacock.
I don't fancy it. Oh God!
I've eaten a pig. I mean, I don't eat any of it now. I'm vegetarian, but it was an awful situation, to be honest. I was doing this thing, and we were eating everything, and somebody said, "Oh, in the Elizabethan era, they used to make these. They were called cockatrices or something. You know, it's when they have, you know, one bird stuffed into another, and then they put a mouse's face on a boar's anus, and suddenly it's got wings. It's like, oh, isn't this wonderful? And look, Geoffrey the small person's popped out of a pie." So we were trying to recreate something of that on a quite limited BBC Factual budget at Penshurst Place. And they were lamenting the lack of peacock. And then 2 hours later, some farmer says, I hear you wanted a peacock. This little shit has been annoying me for years. And he'd just gone and shot it. So there was a lot of footage of me sort of very balefully sort of weeping and sort of mourning it. And then it was overcooked and served to us. I don't recommend it. It was awful. It was really awful. I've done terrible things that I feel... Now I've said that, I just feel nothing but sadness. And now I've given that to you, that feeling, and that's where we're left with.
Quite funny. Thank you. I'll try and carry it with you for the rest of the day. And then we'll have to let it go, Sue, because that's really what has to be done.
This is what I can't do. All right, okay. So the letting go
is... You have to let things go.
The receiving, the animus, the energy of the experience, I can deal with that, doesn't ever dissipate. I can get as wound up by a thing that I saw in India in 2016 now as I did at the time. And it doesn't process.
Well, that's the problem with memory. You know, that is the problem with memory, is that unfortunately it would be great, wouldn't it, if you could have your memories, but they wouldn't drag everything that you felt at the time along with them. Do you see what I mean? If you could remember things without the attendant emotions, then it would be interesting. And that, I suppose, is perhaps a trick that one could learn.
Is that Buddhism?
It's basically Buddhism, yeah.
I remember, I think it's feeling the allowing the flow of time and experience to pass by with a certain degree, depending on what type of Buddhism, I think, of detachment.
Yes. Yes, I suppose so.
I can't detach from anything.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's very hard. It's very hard, and I do think it's probably like a muscular discipline. It's probably something you can learn, you can teach yourself to do.
It feels brutal, though. Do you do that? I can't do it.
What do you mean brutal?
I sort of feel that abandoning the emotional feeling behind an event is a sort of turning one's back on the effect or purpose of it.
But say the emotional feeling that something that happened, let us say, 2 years ago, and it made you feel terrible. What's the use of you feeling terrible 2 years later when it's over and no longer actually relevant? I'm not talking about remorse. Mm. That's absolutely right. But once you've had the remorse and you've felt it, and then you've either done something about it or made amends or done what you can, is it any use thereafter to feel it over and over and over again? I think it's quite debilitating, actually.
Yes, it is. I imagine. But I always take, so for example, I mean, like exes of mine really laugh about it. I'm always a good 5 years exiting a relationship. Oh, and yes. I say, look, you know, sometimes it's a mutual thing, sometimes it's me, sometimes it's them. But just the period of mourning and, I don't know if I've done the right thing. Let me just go back and ask them.
Okay.
And then they're so pissed
that's
off.
All right.
They're so pissed off all the time. So I'm such a prevaricating prick. But it always ends out fine because we're always all mates, thank God. There's no recrimination, but it's just it's so tiring.
It is tiring. And I think that makes you just someone who takes relationships seriously. You think of all the people who end relationships and then just that's it, they're over. That's probably not
that.
Good either, is it?
There's a kind of clarity of thought. I mean, I've been talking about this a lot. I think there's a certain kind of empathy, which is very, very productive.
Yes.
Which enables you to experience with a detached curiosity somebody else's life and to be able, if you can, to help. And then there's, I think it's called somatic, I might be wrong, someone will correct me, empathy, where you're so drowned by somebody else's experience, you are completely fucking useless. And I suspect I fall into the latter camp, although I am trying.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that empathy is incredibly important, and it's probably the most important thing that we need to introduce into our structures and into our institutions, actually, because it's what's lacking, I suppose, from the ways in which we've developed society, social institutions, shall we say, and our cities, shall we say. Empathy, it's very important. I've been thinking about this a lot, thinking about what kind of city would you build? You know, if you're feeling empathy for people, that is to say, if you are able to imagine what it is like to be someone else who has a difficulty, who has a problem, who is suffering, which is what empathy is. It's what I experience. I'm able to imagine it, and therefore I'm able to sympathize. So it's a kind of make a bond. Then I would say you build cities so that they're comfortable for babies and very old people who have to use a wheelchair. And if the cities are comfortable and pleasant and delightful to be in for those two classes of human being, then everyone in the middle will be fine. No one will have to worry about anyone. Everyone else will be fine because the most vulnerable people have been considered first. And that's a sort of city built on empathy.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by June's Journey. Now, June's Journey is a captivating hidden object mobile game which is free to download from iTunes or, as I did, from Google Play. The game is set in the roaring 20s and it looks stunning. So, we follow amateur detective June Parker through beautifully crafted scenes and try and solve the mystery of her sister's murder. It's a perfect escape when you've got 5 minutes to spare and you need a break from the stresses of everyday life. I've been playing it loads over the last few weeks. It's a good way to relax, but also it tests my observational skills, as each scene is a new challenge, finding those hidden objects and discovering more about the murder of Claire and Harry. The hundreds of colourful scenes keep the game fresh and vibrant, while the lightly challenging puzzles keep even my brain active and engaged. It's the perfect balance of relaxing and challenging after a day of recording podcasts. I say a day, as we know, because I called the title this. It's really just an hour. If you enjoy puzzles, murder mystery and great stories, this game is perfect for you, and you can download June's Journey now for your phone or tablet from either iTunes or Google Play by clicking the link in the description of this episode. And I'm assuming your city, which I'm now making you sort of king, queens, president, god, ruler, elite of, or just a very conscientious board member in a democratic sort of socialist set up, whichever you prefer.
Or, you know, a benign dictator.
They get shit done, let's face it.
They get shit done.
So you would, I know you would make it green. So your city would be carbon neutral, plenty of green spaces, big set of green lungs in the middle of it. What would your broad education policy be? I mean, we've talked about free school meals. That's a given now.
Yeah. Oh, lots of things. God. Well, there'd be lots and lots of information about what life is actually like, in the sense that, for instance, where do people keep their electric meters, and where does gas come from, and how do you bleed a fucking radiator?
I have no idea.
You know, and when those little brown envelopes come through, that's your bill. But of course, my city wouldn't have that kind of thing. It wouldn't have a brown envelope arriving. Nothing would be impersonal in that way, because everything would be run and controlled by people.
So put woman who comes to the door and say, you owe us some money. But that's bailiff territory.
No. It wouldn't be like bailiffs. It's not a sort of... it's not a threat. It's that every time you ring the people who put your gas in, you speak to somebody who you probably know. So that all of the pods that are built and the buildings and everybody knows where the stuff is that controls the water and the gas and the electricity, and it's really sort of shared information, and that all the practical things that none of us can do, that we know nothing about, we would know much, much more about, because we'd have learnt about it from when we were little.
And if I might suggest, I mean, you're the dictator,
you're merely a serf.
I'm a serf slash see, I'm very, very happy with that. You've no idea how comforting it is to be just lower order's dog's body with no sense of responsibility.
The responsibility. I don't want it. Can I just say now?
You're the dictator. But I would also say one thing that you can do in your ideal city is to introduce sex education at an appropriate but early age, so that
intimacy and
consent and respect are normalised within sexual relationships. That, I think, would be
from
really early on.
I did a little sex manual for my daughter when she was about eight.
I need some detail. I did a little sex manual.
Well, she'd asked me about what happens when people, how babies were made. And she was very little. I remember I was sitting at my desk and she was about the same height as me sitting down. So I suppose she must have been 9 or something, you know. And I said, okay, well, I did her some drawings. And I said, okay, this is the female business and this is the male business. And this could be quite alarming. But this is what happens. And she looked at me after I'd explained this and done my little drawings, she looked at me with a very sort of a level gaze, I would put it like that, and said, I knew you'd tell me the truth. Now, telling the truth to children at the right time is very much appreciated, I think, and terribly important. And I thought, okay, if you're thinking about this, I'm going to make a little book. And I made lots of little gingerbread men, women, people, forms, human forms. And I said, inside your body, you will feel things, and you will feel things in different parts of your body. And that means something very, very important, because that those feelings are instinctive feelings, and you need to trust them. You absolutely need to trust them. So if you have a funny feeling that's a bit buzzy and grey and uncomfortable in your stomach, then something's wrong. And you need to listen to that. And you need to learn not to suppress it. Because if you listen to it, you'll get away from the situation, or you'll alter the situation and you won't feel it anymore. But a lot of us, particularly women, have been taught to suppress those uncomfortable feelings because we don't want to be rude, or we don't want to be impolite, or be seen as strident, or whatever it is. As well, I said, you know, you're going to have feelings in your throat, in your chest, in your stomach, and in your loins, and they're all going to be telling you different things, and sometimes they'll all come together, be telling you the same things, and that's the person you need to go to bed with.
God, I wish my parents had been like you. I tell you what, I had. I mean, I hope you know me well enough to know that there's no sort of arse licking involved here. It genuinely, that is the best thing you can give a child, is a sense of their own agency and to trust their sense of it, their own instincts. So I was brought up in a sort of Catholic household. I brought up for a little while with by nuns, and they'd obviously advised my parents. We had a sort of family encyclopedia. They'd advised them to cut out, which my dad did rather dutifully before he became an absolute tub thumping atheist and told them all to go fuck themselves. But he had dutifully, with a Stanley knife, cut away the pages on sexual reproduction. I know, because I look for them constantly, and I must have been quite young, probably the sort of round about the 8, 9, 10 mark. And there was an absence of information, but you know, and it turned out fine. But I do think it's an incredibly important thing that parents have to lean into. And I seem to remember my mum talking to me about sex and me just sort of waiting for ages and then just going, that ship has sailed now, Mum. It's just like, where have you been?
How old were you? About 32. Like, yeah.
It's just, yeah. But I think, but I wish I had had those conversations. And I think if I'd been lucky enough to be a parent, I think I would have definitely gone exactly the same way you did. Look, it's really confusing and weird, and you'll make mistakes, and sometimes they'll be really painful. But the mistakes that you don't have to make, or when you feel something's not right and you pull away from it. And it doesn't matter how bad someone else makes you feel for doing that. If it's not right, it's not right.
Yeah, exactly. Vital.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the fun of it, of course, is trial and error, you know, but you have removed hopefully the pain. True.
Yes. I mean, it's the error I'm passionate about, particularly young people of whatever gender, avoiding is, you know, being exploited sexually, because it's very easy to do. It's very easy to do, to groom somebody or to make them feel good. And they're possibly in vulnerable situations in their own families. But they can't follow their instincts. They can't. It's too difficult for them.
But that's fine, because in your benign dictatorship, sex education has been sorted.
Yeah, absolutely. And people would not be, and there wouldn't be prisons and all that sort of malarkey. And essential work would be really the nurses and doctors would be the people who got paid the best. And essential work would be really valued, and it would be so much better.
It would be so much better. And I'm sure there are economists, particularly those sort of centre-right or right, who will place some fault on our utopian model. I mean, admittedly, we haven't sketched out the numbers.
No, we haven't sketched out the numbers. And also, if you speak to feminist economists, they would say, OK, well, we're talking about, I mean, obviously, we're having fun here, but we're talking about circular, sustainable economies. We're talking about the removal of profit as the number one priority of every single institution, business on the planet. That's got to go. It's an old model. It's dead. And it's not serving anyone except a very, very few.
And yet, you know, because everyone's saying, oh, you know, we need to start adjusting to the new normal. For me, it's capitalism 2.0. Really, there has been no... I mean, I don't blame any system or any individual for this. We've all been going through some very strange times.
Yes.
But capitalism will fight to the very end to maintain its status quo, to maintain the you know, the hegemony of the rich and etc. But God, I mean, early doors, I thought, well, maybe something will shift. But increasingly, I just think it's got worse. As you say, the social inequality has got worse. So I guess from where we are, I mean, you do a lot of campaigning, and I hope I try to do good stuff. But I also don't want to forget stories and, you know, particularly at the moment with the arts, I don't want to lose that sense of fun and playtime and music.
Yes, absolutely. I think on the last word on the utopian thing, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that amazing congresswoman, she and Naomi Klein brought out two little movies called A Message from the Future, which are worth watching because they are actually quite beautifully realised visions of how we could live, which is, I mean, none of it is pie in the sky. It is, in fact, common sense. And it's common sense that the capitalism we're living with now will fade and die because it's not sustainable, simply not sustainable. And either that happens very violently and difficultly with endless things like this happening again and again, because this isn't going to be the last pandemic, is it? We all know that. There's going to be COVIDs, all sorts of.
Well, not if people abuse just another disease. Take them from the trees or from the caves.
Well, indeed, and keep flying around like mad, and you know, there's be all sorts of things going to turn up. But if we actually change the way we live, we might be able to deal with them better.
Yes.
So those films are really worth watching. They were only 9 minutes long, 8 minutes. They're very short, but and the first one's about the Green New Deal in America, and the second one is much more sort of global. But that's worth watching. They're worth looking at on YouTube because I found them very helpful.
When it comes to the elderly in your utopia, there's one thing in my mind when I think about that. And I suppose people would look at your work and a lot of people say, oh, my favourite thing that you did was in Love Actually because it broke people's hearts. But the thing that really broke my heart was one line and really affected me. I mean, to the point where I just thought, I've read this book a billion times. Why am I so utterly destroyed by this line? Is Marianne in Sense and Sensibility when her sister is ill. And you're sat by the bed going, please don't leave me on my own. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing.
Yes.
And that tapped in to this incredible feeling of that primal terror of loneliness.
Yes.
I genuinely think that was honestly, that for me, you know, that was the most affecting thing that I've ever seen you do. Because, and obviously you wrote it, but it made sense of what we struggle with, what we've struggled with in isolation during COVID, what we struggle with as we get older, what we struggle with in relationships when we're trying to preserve a sense of autonomy as well as togetherness. Mm. But it made sense of Jane Austen. It made sense. She's somebody I've always struggled with. And actually, no, that the idea that women were kept as... they were kept in sort of prisons, very polite, genteel prisons until they managed to be married off. And if you didn't get married off, life was an unrelenting, miserable hell. And it was, I've taken a big detour, but I had that in my mind as you were talking about it. That was just a really great piece of work.
Well, thank you. And you think about Jane Austen, of course, and her sister was called Cassandra. And Cassandra was absolutely devastated when Austen died at the age of 42. Yeah. Epstein-Barr, I think it was. I can't remember. But anyway.
Was it Epstein-Barr?
Something like that. Something odd. I can't.
God, I didn't know that.
One of those double-barreled named illnesses, which nobody knew anything about. But yeah, she was so, so, so distraught. And you can imagine Eleanor's terror that somehow she'll just...
That's right, it's Eleanor. It'll
just be her.
Marianne's the sister, isn't it? And then Eleanor is the sixth
Eleanor's sister. No, Marianne's the sixth sister. And my character says, Marianne, please do not leave me alone.
See, that for me was like, and it reminds me of, I mean, I'm very lucky. I don't feel alone. I'm very fortunate in my life, and I have I have a lot of sort of connectivity. But I think of my, you know, my grandma, and I think of what, you know, and I think of also not having kids, I guess. And like, oh my God, what's gonna happen?
But isn't it such a waste that we put that people can't live with their close to their grandparents? I mean, that's the care home thing can work very, very well. Of course, people can get on very, very well. But I think we're very lucky because we've got, my mum lives with us, has always lived, as it were, right next to us. And so my kids have always had this old lady in their lives. And in my city, old people and young people would be together all the time. There'd be constant interactions between the very old and the very young because they do each other so much good, and the very young and the very old are much, much more patient with one another than people kind of slightly further down the line. I mean, my I haven't got a granddaughter, crying out loud. My daughter is much more, Christ.
It's coming, hopefully not too soon.
Aging during this podcast. My daughter is really patient with my mum, and she's 20 and mum's 88, you know, and I can be a bit, oh God, mum, a bit nippy or minty if I'm in a bad mood or thing, with both of them actually. So that relationship between the very old and the very young is a very important one. And we don't, I think it's in Norway, they now have old people's homes with young people, teenagers, living there. And it's such a great idea.
I think so.
That's the kind of utopian ideal that's been tried and proven to work very, very well. So,
and I think
utopias are dangerous things. So, but well, that's just practical.
It is. And it's, you can provide, you know, subsidised housing for people just leaving education or just going into apprenticeships, whatever situation they're in, but they live in the same block as smaller
people. Exactly.
And they're just incentivized to go and sort of say hello to them. And the thing is, I just grew up thinking that old people just told stories about the war. Yes. And I'm so my cousin just did some genealogical research into my dad's family, and I just bawled my eyes out because I just thought, why didn't I ask him this stuff when he was alive? And I think when we knew he was dying, we were just so consumed with, are you okay? Are you frightened? Do you need biscuits? You know, those immediate things. But I always feel that elderly people, they're a mistrick. They really are.
Oh, they're totally a mistrick. They're being wasted. All of their knowledge, all of their experience. I'm not saying that all old people are fabulous or all children are fabulous. They're not.
No, there's some
cantankerous old people are
pricks.
Cantankerous, selfish, self, and they're always the ones who live the longest as well. Let's be honest.
It's the ones with triple lock pensions that tend to sort of survive. They'll survive everything. There's kind of economic cockroaches of the new Armageddon.
But you know, if you had. You need access to all ages, and we're also, you know, put into little silos, and because it's easier to sell things to people who are in groups. Yes. It's much easier to control them and to sell things to them. Whereas if you're in a group where you can go to somebody who's 80 and say, do you think this is a good idea? And they said, well, you know what? I did exactly the same thing when I was, and this is what happened. I mean, it may not be relevant, but... And then there's a sort of buffer zone between you and the stuff that we're constantly being sold. We're just being sold stuff all the time. I mean, that, of course, is the computers and back to the social media and the endless and interesting algorithms that are controlling our lives.
But the algorithm, it's really strange. It's not a one-way thing in some ways, because you get to, as you see these adverts pop up as you're just trying to do something quite basic on your phone, you realise, oh, my God, this is me.
Yeah,
this is who you think I am. The other day, I looked at the recommendations and thought, you think I'm a sort of teenage prepper. You think I'm about to go on either a killing spree or about to go sort of loco in the countryside.
Is it not a comfort to you to think, well, they've got me completely wrong, those stupid bloody algorithms? Well, I mean, I'd be very comforted by that. Unfortunately, I get adverts for, you know, incontinence knickers. and, you know, absolutely accurate. And I go,
no,
shit.
Nonsense. No, you're well quite. Known as having the strongest pelvic floor in the business, as well, you know. It's the stuff of legends.
I've worked on that pelvic floor. In my city, there'd be whole pelvic floor areas where nothing would happen except pelvic floor muscles.
Yes.
Muscle of, you know, classes.
Oh God! Oh, no, I'm out. I'm out.
Okay, no, I'm sorry.
I can't. No, I just I've never been able to really embrace.
Contact your pelvic floor.
I bought a little rebounder trampoline. I have some sort of and sort of happily fly around on that thing like a toddler. And a mate of mine who's had a few kids just said, "Oh, you know, the pelvic floor will go." And I went, "Oh bollocks, get on it!" Full flooding. I was like, "You've just weed. You've just weed on my mini trampoline. How can you just?" I warned you. There was no shame.
You've got to be prepared for trampolines.
You see, the thing is, childless as I've been totally blasé. I'm literally bouncing up and down like a. But it's like, what is your problem? Mm. Full flooding, and that is rude. That's rude. Yeah. She claims that I was fair warned, but I had no idea. Well, yes, I'm in some sort of pelvic floor respite.
You weren't making a laugh at the time, were you?
I doubt it. It's unlikely. Super unlikely. I want to ask about the balance, I suppose, in your life, where you find it, your family life, then you have your activism and the things that politically inspire and engage you. Then you have playtime and big wigs and mascara and fun.
Yeah.
And then you have writing, which is purposeful and painful and solitary. How? Yeah. What of those things holds most sway, and what will become, do you think, most important as you get older?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky to have any of those things, aren't I, really? I suppose that's the first thing. Family will necessarily, as you get older, you know, not obviously where I live in my dream city, but you kind of lose people. You know, my mum's 88, so she will die, and my daughter is 20, so she will move away and have her own family. So, You know, at the moment, I'm sort of in between two still active, caring arms, towards senescence of my mother and the post-adolescence of my daughter. Mm. But I'm still very necessary to both of those people. And when I become less necessary or not necessary at all, then the balance of life will necessarily change, because that's the centre of it at the moment.
Yeah,
that's where I'm living at the moment, because those are the, you know, the most important things, the things that have to be done, and they're the first priority. And then and writing, of course, fits around anything. Actually, you can write anywhere, so it's a very good thing to have lying around, because if you have an accident, or, you know, you're okay. I mean, I hope I don't get COVID, but I suppose if I did and I wasn't able to do anything, or maybe I could just have brain fog and I wouldn't be able to write either. But writing's useful in the sense that you can do it anywhere. If I were having to care for my mum as I was in Scotland, because, you know, that was just the job, I could write. So we're writing the musical of Nanny McPhee at the moment. So it's easy to make a little space.
Yeah.
And right, so those two things are very good. And that, then with acting, you've got to work out, well, who needs me? Am I able to go and do this job? Am I able to leave to do this job? Or actually, could this job happen in London? Because I love working in England and Scotland. I love working here. Mm. I prefer it to anywhere else. So all the work that's possibly happening is all going to be here. And that's a great help, because I don't want to travel so much.
Did you always resist the stateside life?
Yeah.
Because you won, when did you win Oscars? How old were you?
About 32, 33.
My God.
The first one for Howard's End. And then I think I was 37 or something when I won for Sense, the writing one.
Bloody hell. That's just the double by 37.
Yes, but it doesn't feel like that. It's not like that. Because you're not even aware. You're not aware of it. I mean, I was so innocent about things like the Oscars. They weren't really a big thing in our lives here.
I used to stay up and watch them.
Yeah, but you're younger than me, sweetheart.
But it was the most unspeakably glamorous thing from when I was a kid. Because it's so outside of my realm of experience, achievement, whatever it might be. And also, you know, I happy childhood, but very the sort of endless rolling beigeness of Croydon. And
I've played, you know, Croydon.
You play it once. Not even on the way up and the way down. You just play it once.
I played it once, the Croydon Warehouse. I had a very good audience.
Do you know what? The Warehouse was great. It's the Fairfield Halls you've got to watch out for. It's a fab venue, but acoustically difficult. Acoustically very difficult. God, anyway, that's a very niche comment by me. But for me, it was always like, maybe it was about the fact that people wore ball gowns, which I knew I would thankfully never have to squeeze myself into. But it's like, look, there's people in ball gowns. And they're still managing to walk. And I used to feel so frightened when I would see them teeter up the steps.
Yes.
And even then I think, God, what a needlessly stressful thing to make a woman do. She's already shitting herself.
Exactly.
That, you know, that she's got to pick this thing up. Don't. And do a nice speech.
Don't. Am I the shoes? No. And you just spend... I can remember one year, actually the year I won for Sense and Sensibility, I had a pair of shoes on. And they just wouldn't stay on, and they were too high, and they wouldn't stay on. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? I can't get down the bloody red carpet in these. And who was it? It was somebody who was staying in the hotel. She was queen of somewhere. I can't remember what country.
She was queen of somewhere.
She was a fucking queen. And I was just passing the thing. And I said, have you got any sellotape, have you? And she said, I'm wearing some, you don't mind borrowing these. I mean, I have been wearing these shoes, and she had some insoles. She said, do you want them? So, and they were all kind of warm. A hot queen's insoles I got. And I put them on, and they saved my bacon, can I tell you?
That is majestic. The fact that you're, because I do imagine that everyone's just rubbing around, but all these sort of A-listers rubbing their center, and the queen of somewhere, you didn't even ask where, perhaps you were too dazzled, where. Gave you a hot insole so that you could teeter up and accept this big bastard gold man.
In that sense, high heels are quite a leveling experience, you know, because all the women are in agony. I will not wear them anymore. I just
Well, no, I find any event, particularly an award event, so challenging that I need to have something on that I can run away in.
There are far too many of them. I mean, you know, the Oscars and the Globes used to be quite fun, actually, because they were a little bit less serious and taken less seriously because they weren't used in quite the same way to make money. They were a celebration, if you like, whereas now... I think they've become if you get your film the Oscar, then the film will make that much more money, you know, and it's all gone a bit sort of lowering. But the thing itself, the event itself, because my mum came to both of them, is very surreal, very surreal. And mum was wearing a train, I remember, at one of them, and everyone who trod on it and yanked her head back was famous. So she kept on going, you know, just being
so she
choked.
Had whiplash by the end of it.
Yeah, whiplash by the end. But, you know, it was Placido Domingo who'd given her the whiplash. So it
bloody
was okay.
Hell. Yes, exactly. As long as it's a celebrity anecdote to go with the osteopathic crisis. it's important, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just find the idea of you at the... It's interesting. Do you know what I mean? I mean, some people are just... That's why they do the job.
Oh, yeah. No, if that's why you do the job, then I think that you shouldn't be doing the job.
No.
Usually. You should just walk away from that because it's so, so random and nonsense, really. Yes. If everyone knows, it's kind of mad and silly. But if it can be fun and made theatrical and made fun to watch, then all power to them.
I've learned a lot. I've learned that you're now the benign dictator of a place where kids get taught, you know, how to trust their own instincts, where the elderly get listened to, their stories get properly sort of understood and passed down, they're looked after by the young, where key workers are valued, where there's a pelvic floor arena where stories
are
told.
A bit, I've taken that too far. That was a gag.
It's
take
in,
that out.
It's in. The the construction's already begun. This is the problem with dictatorship, is that you say it's done.
Oh, you're right. You're so right.
It's done. Okay, but thank God the construction industry is being paid incredibly well, because they're providing a key service to those with basically bladders like wet plasterboard. And then, yes, there's lots of Greek mythology classes and Norse legends going on. There's a springboard for the imagination. And for anyone in crisis, in any social event, there's a random queen from who fucking knows where with a hot insole. I'm signed up. Count me as your most loyal serf. It's all good. And thank you for your time.
Oh, it's lovely to talk to you, Sue. All my love as ever, and I'll see you in person.
Yeah, I hope so. Time. Just the weirdness of times.
Yes. Yeah. We just got to do a lot of breathing, let go, take care, all that.
As always, a big thanks and lots of love to Emma. I can't wait to live in her city. And of course, the music for this episode and for all of the series is by Waiting for Smith. You can find more of his music on YouTube and Spotify. All I do is stare at the view. I'll be heading east to find my peace where the desert feasts.